From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last Saturday, as WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange sat in a British prison cell fighting extradition to Sweden for questioning on allegations of rape, Saturday Night Live's Bill Hader offered this impersonation.
Hello again. It's me, Julian Assange. I've taken over your airwaves from inside a British prison. How'd I get a camera into a British prison? Maybe you weren't listening. I'm Julian Assange.
This week, Assange was released on bail while U.S. prosecutors scrambled to find a way to prosecute him for publishing classified documents. Attorney General Eric Holder has given investigators the go-ahead to take, quote, significant steps in building a case against Assange. But so far, the Justice Department can't find a crime with which to charge him. This week, 19 members of the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism sent a letter to Holder and President Obama urging restraint. Quote, as a historical matter, government overreaction to publication of leaked material in the press has always been more damaging to American democracy than the leaks themselves. Todd Gitlin is the chair of Columbia Journalism School's PhD program and a signatory to the letter. Todd, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Okay, I'm just going to give us a little legal background. Officials have looked into the 1917 Espionage Act and the 1986 Computer Fraud and Abuse Acts, but arresting publishers, and that's what Assange is, runs afoul of the First Amendment. So justice is trying to learn if Assange actually enticed or helped the Army analyst who's the alleged leaker. That would make Assange a conspirator and not just a recipient, which would likely clear the First Amendment hurdle. If that doesn't fly, there's even talk of a new law, the so-called Shield Act, that's designed to go specifically after WikiLeaks. Legal scholars say it's clearly unconstitutional. Its adherents say it would protect America. Others call the whole effort a witch hunt. What say you, Todd?
I, among other signers of this letter, have actually not signed up to the Julian Assange fan club. But Assange is a publisher. One can criticize the way he's gone about it. There are plenty of arguments to be had about how different news organizations should function vis-a-vis WikiLeaks. That's a whole different question. What we object to is the idea of coming in with the heavy hand of the law.
And you say that, in particular, the Espionage Act seems to have no relevance to the situation.
Well, the Espionage Act is this nightmare passed in a blink in 1917 at a time when there was a declaration of war, at a time when there was a clearly defined state enemy, at a time when there was a high degree of paranoia that ended up placing luminous figures in the history of American democracy behind bars. I mean, the notion that Assange is a terrorist or that WikiLeaks is a terrorist organization says something miserable, I think, about the state of our public language.
You and the other signatories to the letter are on record opposing prosecution of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. Are you also defending his decision to publish these classified diplomatic documents?
You don't prosecute for making material public, even if, in my own judgment, that material should not be. But I'm not the czar of information. I don't think I should be. I don't think that Eric Holder should be. There is more reason to worry about the chilling effect than there is to worry about the consequences of any particular leak. There are parts of the media that I think are scurrilous and I would not think responsible. But the way freedom of the press works, you have to defend the whole caboodle. The First Amendment is not just about freedom of journalists. The word journalist is not mentioned in the Constitution.
This letter represents a very rare case of unanimity among the staff of the Columbia J School.
We generally don't do that sort of thing. We are in our cubicles teaching our classes, and the fact that this letter circulated and accumulated these signatures in a weekend tells you about the sense of urgency that people in our building feel.
The same day that 19 members of the Columbia J School sent its missive to the Attorney General and the President, the board members of Australia's equivalent of the Society of Professional Journalists sent a letter to the Prime Minister of Australia, Julia Gillard. Now, the signatories to this letter were heavy dudes in Australia, the equivalent of our major networks, our New York Times, our Washington Post, our public broadcasting networks, the leading websites, and they all urged her to cool her rhetoric. They said, quote, "We will strongly resist any attempts to make publication of these or similar documents illegal. Any action would impact not only on WikiLeaks, but on every media organization in the world that aims to inform the public about decisions made on their behalf. WikiLeaks, just 4 years old, is part of the media and deserves our support." Where are our major media outlets on this?
Assange has worked with credited news organizations, above-ground news organizations, to make things available. And that would seem to me that it is incumbent upon the official press to recognize that it has been de facto roped in with WikiLeaks. They're part of the same enterprise.
And the enterprise you're talking about is journalism.
Well, it's certainly journalistic activity. Now, it's striking to me that after the initial dumps of data about the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, there was no urgent debate among journalists about the legitimacy of doing that, because I think everybody seemed to understand that there was a great deal of information about what was going on in Iraq and in Afghanistan, which people did not have, and it spoke to the moral responsibilities of Americans, and therefore it was sort of taken for granted, I think, that there was genuine news value here. There was no question that the reports of military action were newsworthy, but the diplomatic cables created a new situation. Were all these cables newsworthy? Were there risks? I think we shouldn't kid ourselves. There can be consequences from the release of a particular piece of information. But to declare that WikiLeaks is a terrorist organization, that it should be in some way banished or driven from nation to nation, from mirror site to mirror site, that, it seems to me, is very, very serious overreach.
What impact, if any, do you think your letter will have?
You know, the hope of those who put together the letter was that we were entering into a fluid situation in which the opinion of a group of professors at President Obama's alma mater might ring. This was a spontaneous effusion. This was, the building is humming with apprehension as well as hope and trying to stay alert.
Todd, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Todd Gitlin is the chair of the Columbia Journalism School's PhD program. Arrest, intrigue, moral ambiguity, just another day in the never-ending story that is WikiLeaks. We talked last week about a loose faction of online activists called Anonymous, responsible for the so-called distributed denial-of-service attacks that crashed websites that had fled from WikiLeaks, including MasterCard, Visa, and PayPal. In a press release, Anonymous wrote, quote, "We are average internet citizens. Our current goal is to raise awareness about the underhanded methods employed by the above companies to impair WikiLeaks' ability to function."
In defending their denial of service attacks, illegal under U.S. law, Anonymous cited internet theorist Yevgeny Morozov, who suggested such acts can be legitimate expressions of dissent. Can be. And so, in an essay this week in Slate, Morozov asks, do the Anonymous attacks rise to the level of civil disobedience? In answering it, Morozov used the criteria laid out by philosopher John Rawls in his 1971 treatise, A Theory of Justice. Were the attacks public and were authorities notified? Yes. Were they nonviolent? Check. Were they conscientious and motivated by moral convictions? Arguably. And finally, were the lawbreakers willing to accept the legal consequences of their actions? Originally, Morozov's answer was, not so much. The Anonymous attackers were, after all, anonymous. But we spoke to Morozov via Skype from Belarus, and he says he's since kind of changed his mind.
I've been tracking some of the reaction from the Anonymous members themselves, and some of them actually claim that their attacks can be easily traced to their computers and that they can be arrested. So I myself have slightly changed my mind on this issue also, because some of them are willing to take the risks and they're willing to go to jail.
All right, so let's say some percentage of the Anonymous hackers realize they could be traced and put in some legal jeopardy. It leaves open the question, though, about the Rawls stipulation for conscientiousness and moral conviction. To what extent do we have evidence that these are conscientious actors behaving thoughtfully or just a mob?
First of all, I think it's not correct to call them hackers. They have not broken into any databases. They have not stolen any data. So they actually themselves dispute that term, and I think they do it correctly. But in terms of whether they have moral convictions and whether they're pursuing any sort of agenda for change, I think they are. In this particular case, they didn't like Amazon and PayPal and MasterCard and Visa for what they think was a very unfair treatment of WikiLeaks and for succumbing to government pressure. So from that perspective, I think they definitely had a claim, and I think they actually had good reasons behind that claim for launching those attacks. As we wouldn't dispute their protests in front of Amazon's front door or in front of PayPal's office, I think this is legitimate.
If this fulfills Rawls' stipulation, well, then can anybody decide that any business's practices for any reason justify this kind of denial of service attack? How much do we have to fear about just total pandemonium?
It's definitely an issue since the so-called cyber war between Russia and Estonia in 2007. Denial of service attacks have been getting more and more media coverage. They have become easier to launch. I mean, now it's a point-and-click kind of warfare. You know, all you have to do is specify the target. And the European Union, for example, now some of their commissioners are thinking of setting up a dedicated hotline for reporting denial of service attacks and maybe even dedicating some kind of a digital SWAT team. I myself have written a lot about the ways in which such attacks are being misused against independent media in places like Belarus or Azerbaijan or Kazakhstan or Lebanon. I mean, it's very easy to shut down an independent newspaper with the help of denial of service attacks. So it's definitely a very complex and increasingly disturbing issue. I just don't think that the way to go forward is to criminalize all of that, because I think it will only embolden the likes of Anonymous to make their attacks even more sophisticated and to get even more people inside their ranks.
Yevgeny, as always, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Yevgeny Morozov is a visiting scholar at Stanford University and author of the forthcoming The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Netflix recently debuted a new much-awaited streaming-only option for its customers. At around $8 per month, the plan is a cheaper alternative for consumers who primarily use the movie rental website's Watch Instantly option, which is a lot of people. The company that started out renting DVDs through the mail now delivers more content online than it does through the post office. The demand for Netflix streaming has grown so much, in fact, that it accounts for 20% of all download traffic during peak internet times. There's just one problem. Netflix's difficulty in acquiring content licenses means its streaming library is much smaller than its DVD library. The company is on a mission to increase the size and quality of its streaming catalog, but a threatened cable and media industry may not make it very easy for them. Writer Tim Arango has been following the Netflix saga for the New York Times. Tim, welcome to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
It wasn't so long ago that this was a company that almost quaintly would deliver DVDs by mail, and just doing that had an effect on the movie business. Is it true that they're no longer seen as a benefit to Hollywood, but as a threat?
Well, when they came around in the late 90s, they were eagerly embraced as additional revenue to the DVD sales business. They came at a time when no one was quite sure about the future of online video and said, hey, let us try this out, give us a good deal, and this is just going to be some extra revenue for you. And the media companies and the studios didn't anticipate that it would be so spectacularly successful that it would end up in a very short order being a real threat to the economics, particularly of cable television.
Cable is in competition with Netflix on its video on demand, and cable fetches a lot more for a movie than Netflix does, right?
Absolutely. And one of the arguments that a lot of people make is that Netflix has been so successful because the cable companies have not been able to provide a very good on-demand service as an alternative. They don't have the selection that Netflix does, and it often doesn't work. The second part with the cable economics is that economic model where customers pay per month, you know, $100, $125, that's been the most durable of any of the media businesses. And for the first time in history this year, cable television subscriptions are down.
In your piece, you talk about the $25 million that Netflix originally paid Starz for access to a whole mess of movies. And now you say that it's going to cost Netflix $250 million to renegotiate when the contract expires next year. Why was Starz in a position to give them rights to anything?
Because when Starz did their deal with Sony and Disney, they kept the rights to digitally exploit those movies, to stream those movies. And I think Starz just felt like, okay, this is not going to impact our business. People are not going to think about cutting cable. This will be extra. So that's why it was so low.
You know, we've been discussing movies, Tim. Netflix also will stream TV programs, but nothing that is currently in season. There is a lag. How is that going to play out?
Well, we've seen one very recent deal that has caused shockwaves in the media industry, and that was a deal with NBC for Saturday Night Live. On Netflix now, you can get Saturday Night Live the next day. It actually goes up Monday, but the deal is for the next day, Sunday. That caused a lot of consternation at other companies because that could really impact the business model of syndication. It can impact the business model of, you know, reruns and things like that. Netflix is trying to get fresher and fresher TV content, and you'll see a big resistance to that because then if you can get TV shows the next day, the next week, you really have to answer the question, why am I paying for cable?
So your best guess, when it comes to streaming Hollywood films or any other kind of film for that matter, who do you see as being best positioned to dominate, let's say, over the next 10 years?
I think my best guess is that Netflix probably won't be able to keep up the same momentum that they have. I think their success has been a wake-up call to the big media companies that they need to act faster to offer their own alternatives. And I think you'll see experimenting with cable packages so you can have smaller tiers. And I also think you're going to have this idea that Jeff Bukas at Time Warner talked about where if you're an authenticated cable subscriber, you can get all those channels online on any device. And I think they're going to move faster at that. And I think in doing so, they will protect their business model.
TV Anywhere, they call that, right?
TV Anywhere, absolutely.
It sounds like a very chaotic scenario.
The whole thing is very chaotic. That's what's made the whole story very, very interesting, because in such a short time, Netflix has positioned itself at the center of this entire debate about the future of how Americans and people all over the world will watch television and movies in their home.
Tim, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Tim Arango writes for The New York Times. Midas Schmidas, what you want to have is the Oprah touch.
Here is the deal. If your box has a key, you will be the last person today to get one of those cute little G6s.
Maybe I should take all of you with me to the other side of the world.
Open your box. One, two, three.
Whatever that woman gets behind turns into a blockbuster. First her syndicated TV show, then O Magazine, not to mention every book she features on her program. Oprah Winfrey is a maker of hits, at least so far. As of January 1st, Oprah will have her own cable channel called, in fact, OWN. So naturally, this will be a huge shot in the arm for cable TV, right? Well, maybe and maybe not. Oprah is making her move just as cable, the relatively robust half of the TV business, is beginning to fray at the edges. Here to talk more about the challenges ahead for Oprah is Advertising Age's television editor Brian Steinberg. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Hi, how are you, Bob?
Well, thank you. So let's start with history. Moving from broadcast to cable hasn't always been a particularly smooth transition, huh?
Depends who it is, but what's definitely going to happen is you're going to get smaller audiences at any given time. I mean, Conan O'Brien is not getting Tonight Show audiences. He is getting a good healthy chunk of young viewers. Martha Stewart recently made the journey from daytime syndicated programming to Hallmark. That has not been a good move. Her shows are not doing very well on Hallmark. There are economic challenges when you trade in a bigger audience of broadcast to the fragmentation of cable.
And complicating the problem, cable subscriptions, the total cable universe, isn't going in the right direction.
That's right. There is this new phenomenon they call over-the-top TV viewing, where you watch TV through an interface that is not your TV set to. Maybe you're watching Google TV, or you're watching Hulu, or you're streaming through Netflix, or you're watching it through a video game device. There is a lot of scrambling going around, a lot of hand-wringing about how to get people to pay for the shows when they're not paying for the subscription that would bring them into the house.
Now, we've discussed the risk, but you recently quoted a guy from the industry who said this is not a normal startup because she's going to bring her established audience with her.
First of all, this is an already existing cable channel. They don't need to go out and convince Time Warner and Cox and Comcast to pick this channel up. It's already there. Now you have the process of Oprah coming on board, and, you know, advertisers have dealt with her for many years. They know the golden touch she brings when she brings a new car or when she brings a new book up there. And I think they're hoping that that kind of halo effect carries. Now, of course, the question is not every show on OWN is going to be featuring Oprah.
Give me a for instance. What's the schedule look like?
Well, I would expect this to be very written in sand rather than stone. They are bringing Rosie O'Donnell. She's going to do a show called Masterclass, which is, you know, artisans and artists, people who offer kind of their take on their lives. There's, various Oprah figures like Dr. Phil. There's a sex therapy program, the show featuring Ashley Judd, a show featuring Sarah Ferguson. There's a reality show behind the scenes of Oprah's last year on broadcast TV. The themes are generally wellness and good life and good living and that sort of thing.
And aspiration and redemption and other familiar Oprah themes. So you can get an Oprah-esque experience every time you click on the channel. It makes me wonder if, what if Oprah could be the first programmer who created kind of a homepage of our cable channel that 20 million women around the United States, when they turn on their TV, it would be OWN and the TV would stay on OWN all day to get this Oprah-like fare. Is that even within the realm of possibility?
Oh, I think so. I mean, you know, technology is changing so quickly, and I do think, you know, the idea of using the TV screen as an interface to surf the web and watch streaming video are all coming. Yes, there is a notion of Oprah being kind of a central figure who might be your landing page. Just like when you turn the TV on, sometimes your cable news comes on, and you can then flip from there.
Bottom line, Brian, we're looking at an industry that has been enormously profitable, but is facing some very big challenges from fragmentation and from people canceling their cable TV subscriptions. And then there's Oprah, who succeeds at everything she tries. It's kind of like an irresistible force against an immovable object. What is going to happen? She can't possibly succeed in this environment. But is she gonna?
Do I think this is going to launch 100% smoothly? No. Do I think they're going to change the schedule and yank programming and try new stuff very quickly? Yes. If you follow her launches, they take a long time. People come in and out. She's an entrepreneur. She's got a vision. She tries to articulate it. If you're not getting it, move along. Her magazine kind of had a scattered launch where the initial editor left after a few months and they brought somebody else in. I don't think it's going to be 100% success from the get-go. I think advertisers also expect there to be a little bit of to and fro and some churn until they figure out what works and what doesn't.
If Oprah tapped you on the shoulder and said, "Hey, Brian, come over and work with me," do you go?
I think I asked if I got a severance package or not. You go with the idea it would be a 2-year experiment, and if it works, it works.
Okay, Brian, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Brian Steinberg covers television for Advertising Age. And now a word from our sponsors.
Removing dishes while cooking can be too hot to handle. Ouch! The Of Glove. Now with non-slip silicone grips. The Of Glove.
Mama Lucia on a roll. Mama Lucia on a plate. Mama Lucia meatballs. Have a taste that's really great.
Mama Lucia meatballs, America's favorite.
Needless to say, we are not actually sponsored by the Of Glove or Mama Lucia. We played those ads to illustrate the point of our next story, which is that compared to the content of our show, those ads probably blared out of your radio or MP3 player at a jarringly high volume. Well, this month, Congress approved legislation that will require television advertisers to turn down the volume on excessively loud commercials. The Commercial Advertising Loudness Mitigation, or CALM Act, will keep TV ads from being louder than the programs they sponsor, following the international standards set by the United Nations. Wall Street Journal reporter Elizabeth Williamson wrote about the legislation. Elizabeth, welcome to OTM.
It's nice to be here, Bob.
Now, I have to tell you, this is a very, very personal subject for me, because I live in a household where I am held personally responsible for all that ails the universe, you know, whether it's sunspots or terrorism or the volume of a TV commercial suddenly getting very loud and disturbing the household. I get the fisheye, Garfield, turn that down. I have to assume that others have been bedeviled by this for a long time.
Indeed, they have. For 50 years, people have complained to the Federal Communications Commission about the loudness of their television ads. And the FCC, after 1984 or so, discovered the mute button and recommended that people use that.
The mute button, yeah, but, you know, that requires a lot of proactive participation and a fundamentally passive exercise, TV watching. Why has the government deemed it my responsibility to preempt the wall of sound that hits me when the commercial break begins?
At the time when they were really recommending the mute button, and they still do that, they were in a deregulatory mode, so they didn't really want to be in charge of regulating the sound of TV commercials. But really, the answer is more technological. People perceive sound differently depending on how old they are, depending on the technology the sound is coming out of, depending on whether it's conversation or other forms of noise.
I have to say that my personal experience is that the increase in volume is so abrupt that it's hard to believe that the peak volume of the commercial matches anything that I've just heard in the actual programming that preceded it.
When the engineers create these ads, the peak sound in the programming adjacent to the commercial had to be just slightly louder than the constant sound of the commercial. So what would happen would be you'd have a cop show, for example, and you'd have a bomb blast and then the bit of quiet dialogue. And then all of a sudden, you'd have an ad that the entire volume of the ad was geared to the bomb explosion that you just heard. So it really would blast you off the couch.
And then the subsequent advertiser has to out-volume the previous advertiser and turns the dial from, you know, 10.5 to 11.
They'd all try and outgun each other. And what had happened in the United States is that people had switched to digital. And you can pump a lot of sound down a digital signal without distortion. So you had crystal clear, really loud sound and thousands of complaints coming into the FCC.
Technical issues had made this kind of a tough nut to crack, but Congress cracked it this time. What changed?
The technology changed. People generally agreed on what constitutes loudness in human conversation. You could determine a loud voice from one that was comfortable for you to hear. But when it came to other types of noises, people varied widely. So what they decided to do was to create a machine that could average out sound based on what's comfortable for conversation. Because if people have a level of comfortability with the loudness of conversation, then the ads should be based on that.
This has got to be the safest, the most popular piece of legislation that's come out of Congress since the mortgage interest deduction.
Yeah. Anna Eshoo of California, Democrat from Silicon Valley, took this up because her elderly parents were with her and they cranked the TV and were blowing her out of her own home with the TV ads. So she pushed this legislation. She says that people are stopping her in the gas station, in the grocery store, on the street in her district, and thanking her for this.
This is a woman who probably now could vote for cutting Social Security and Medicare benefits and maybe for declaring war against Rhode Island and still get reelected.
Pretty close, according to Representative Eshoo. She says that if she had saved 50 million children from some malady, she would probably generate less thanks than she has by pushing this legislation.
This was the rare bit of bipartisanship and, you know, Republican-Democratic kumbaya in the halls of Congress. But there was a moment when it wasn't all so bipartisan-y.
There was some floor debate. The Republican critics of this bill thought that this was an unnecessary intrusion by the federal government into the private sector and private life. A couple of the legislators stood up and said, now, if we regulate the loudness of TV ads, what's next? What's the ridiculous extreme we could reach here? We could wind up regulating the types of things that are even advertised on TV. And of course, it was pointed out to them that, well, we have already done that.
Elizabeth, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure, Bob.
Elizabeth Williamson is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
Free Crazy Eddie t-shirts, free Crazy Eddie baseball caps today through Sunday, 999 3rd Avenue between 59th and 60th in Manhattan. Go there today.
Coming up, online vendors think they know what you're willing to spend on their goods. Stay tuned for holiday tips on how to game their system.
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from Constant Contact, dedicated to the success of small businesses and nonprofits. Learn about email marketing at constantcontact.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. This is NPR.
Hurry, hurry, hurry! The time is running out for that fabulous tax deduction you'll get from helping On the Media. Just in the last few weeks, we've had penetrating coverage of the WikiLeaks phenomenon, and Bob got Kitty Kelly to concede that she may not get to heaven. So text OTM to 25383. A $10 donation will appear on your phone bill. Messaging and data rates apply. Thanks.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Online shopping sales will soon reach their annual peak. Last year, the most profitable day for online merchants was December 15th, when they took in $913 million, and that total is predicted to rise. The bad news for internet retailers? Online customers are more fickle than their brick-and-mortar brethren, more likely to window shop, more prone to compare prices, and much less loyal to any particular store. Retailers have tried to level the playing field with some digital tricks, among them dynamic pricing, which essentially means changing the price of a good based on what they think a consumer is willing to pay. If the e-store you're browsing in believes you're tight with a dollar, it might lure you in with a lower price or free shipping. If they think you're willing to spend a bit more, well, they may ask you to. Annie Lowry, who covers business and the economy for Slate, says that dynamic pricing has always existed on some goods, but that it's begun to pop up in places you wouldn't expect.
We know that for airline tickets, for hotel rooms, for car rentals, for credit cards, for debit cards, for other financial products, when there's a lot of variability in the pricing already and the goods might be time sensitive or tied to the consumer very specifically, we know that dynamic pricing happens online for all of those goods fairly consistently. What we're looking at now is how dynamic pricing is influencing the sales numbers and the purchase prices for goods that aren't time sensitive, and that there isn't any real logical explanation for why one person should pay some set price for a DVD and another person should pay a different price.
Can you give me an idea of the kind of information that vendors might use to set prices differently for different customers?
One way to think about this happening is to think about not just if you're buying one good and putting it in your shopping basket online and checking out, but say that you're buying a number of goods over the course of a day. Perhaps a company will look into your cookies and will look at your purchase history with the company and will say, you know, she has 5 things in her shopping basket. Why don't we offer her discounts on the 6th and the 7th? And why don't we offer her free shipping? Whereas somebody using a different browser with different cookies on their computer will have higher price.
Is all of this legal?
It is legal. It is illegal for companies to discriminate based on age or race. But they can absolutely charge different prices to different customers depending on things like your sales history, your cookies, your browser. It's not illegal for a company to charge two different people two different prices for the same good on the same day, even in the same second. That's not illegal.
What can consumers do about this? And what I'm asking for here, Annie, are some pre-Christmas shopping tips. How do you game the system?
So it's still early days for retailers. They're still figuring out the best ways to do this, and they're still putting a lot of research and time into figuring out how to best optimize prices for, you know, their own sales and their own purposes. So therefore, it's actually pretty easy to game the system. One thing that customers can do is that if they're shopping at big online retailers, they can try using two different browsers. They can clear out the cookies on one browser or maybe do something called private browsing, and then also do it in their regular browser that they use every day. If there's a difference between any price, any interest rate, if there's any offers that pop up on one browser or another, you're probably being subject to dynamic pricing and you probably want to be careful. Another thing that you can do is you can put items into a shopping basket and leave the shopping basket. There's a lot of evidence that companies are becoming a lot more savvy about offering you free shipping and offering you discounts if you just leave things in a basket for a while, because they'll want you to purchase them and they'll want to spur you to purchase them. Another thing to do is just to keep an eye on consumer reports. If companies are caught doing this brazenly, there tends to be a pretty public outcry about it. And so you can check some of the consumer blogs or the consumer groups. And one sort of final way to game the system is also just to ask companies for discounts. If you email customer service, there's some evidence that some companies online will actually happily do it.
And you also recommend, and this is a rare product endorsement, if you want to beat dynamic pricing, at least for the time being, it's worthwhile not just to use a different browser, but specifically to use Chrome, which now carries the connotation of being savvy.
Yeah, so if you use a schmancier browser, a newer, a more tech-savvy browser like a Google Chrome, as opposed to something like Internet Explorer, yeah, there's a chance that you might be quoted lower prices for things on some goods at least.
Okay, so looking at this business and all the other instances in which our online behavior is tracked and used, does it make you want to wipe your slate clean, or are you fundamentally okay with it?
It certainly gives you pause. It's certainly a little eerie that companies can know so much about you without you telling them. It does feel a little bit invasive. And it's worrisome to even think that you might have to shop with two different browsers or to think that you might need to be gaming the companies because they're gaming you. But the truth is that that always happens, and it happens in really variable ways. And because there are ways to counteract this, and because the consumer has so much power online, where it is so easy to comparison shop and so easy to find information about different companies and different products and, you know, how companies are using your data or how companies are selling different people different things, ultimately, the consumer really is king here. And the fact that companies are doing this is a lot in response to the fact that consumers have forced them to bring prices down so much online by comparison shopping.
Annie, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Annie Lowrey reports on economics and business for Slate. Right now, the laws about how far companies can peek into your personal information online are pretty vague. The federal government has taken a hands-off approach to online privacy for fear of interfering with online commerce. Technology companies have complained that even if they want to follow the rules, it's difficult to know what's okay and what isn't. The good news, this week, the Obama administration called for the creation of a privacy policy office. The privacy policy office will create a, quote, privacy bill of rights, a framework that's supposed to spell out the rules about data gathering online. On the morning of December 16, 1960, two airplanes, one an old TWA plane bound for LaGuardia Airport, the other a state-of-the-art United turbojet headed to Idlewild, collided in the fog over New York City.
The flaming wreckage from one of the planes landed in the so-called transitional neighborhood of Park Slope, Brooklyn, destroying several buildings, including the Pillar of Fire Church.
The church is completely demolished. The several other buildings are completely afire. And very heavy smoke is blanketing the entire area.
The New York Times ran a triple banner headline and described what was then the worst air disaster in American history, more than 130 dead both in the air and on the ground. 50 years later, the New York Times is once again covering the story. A handful of staff members are walking the streets, literally re-reporting the events of that day. Overseeing the project is Wendell Jameson, deputy metro editor for nytimes.com. He says disaster coverage has come a long way. Wendell, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk first about the people who died that day. What sort of details were published in the paper?
People on that plane included businessmen, college students, a little boy named Stephen Boltz, who was the only survivor. And the newspapers that covered the disaster listed all their names and in some cases explained why they were on the plane. But there was no sense of who these people were. Today, if something like this would happen at the New York Times or at any of the newspapers I've worked for, you'd really strive to do a portrait of these people's lives. What we did in the case of Stephen Boltz, the survivor, was really report out his life in great, great detail, not just why he was on the plane or what happened to him after he was thrown from the plane, but his life making model airplanes at home and being in the Boy Scouts and going camping with his family.
Now, Stephen didn't live long after that crash.
That's right. He lived until the next morning. And the whole city and perhaps the whole country kind of watched him very closely. He was the one little bit of good news from this horrible story. And so for a lot of people, it was a real crushing second tragedy when he died the next day.
Why do you think it's de rigueur now in journalism to sketch the biographies of people who die in major disasters? Did it start with the Times, with 9/11 and the portraits of grief, which were portraits of the people who died in the towers, and you were part of that?
I was the editor of that. It didn't start with that, but that might be one of the largest examples of this form. Every day we put in the names of someone who died in Afghanistan or Iraq, and often the people who die then become the focus of larger feature stories. It's a big challenge, but I just think it's important to do because otherwise it's just a bunch of numbers, and it's very hard to really experience what has been lost here if you don't know these people.
So how are you doing that for a 50-year-old tragedy?
Well, in the case of Stephen, who's the one we really focused on, David Dunlap, a real premier writer at the New York Times, spent many weeks getting to know his family. Stephen's younger brother, William, has never really spoken of this. He's still quite haunted by it. But in the end, he agreed to be interviewed just by email by David. And his response turned out to be more than 3,000 words long and is an absolutely beautiful essay about his little brother and about that time in America and in growing up in Illinois. I run a blog called City Room with Andy Newman, who's the bureau chief, and we have no limitations of space as one with the newspaper, so we're just going to run the whole essay, 3,000 words. You really walk away knowing this kid as a living, breathing, great little boy and not a tragic, burned figure.
Full disclosure, I've lived in Park Slope since 1995, and even briefly on the very corner of Sterling and 7th Avenue where the wreckage fell. It's kind of interesting. You discovered from going back over the old coverage that there was a coded description of that neighborhood back in 1960.
I, by the way, moved to Park Slope with my parents in 1969 and lived there until I went to college in the early 80s. And I lived on St. John's Place around the corner and was also always fascinated by this. And yes, the newspapers called it a neighborhood in transition. You can't see me, but I'm making that little quotation mark with my fingers. It was a rough neighborhood. And Emily Rube, one of our writers, did a story looking at Park Slope in 1960 before the plane came down. And I think it would really surprise many people who live there now. It's really a very beautiful and very upscale neighborhood.
But it was featured in a film in the 70s, a film called The Landlord, as the quintessential New York slum.
Yes, I've seen that. And it was a rough neighborhood. And Emily found stories about a shop owner of a florist who kept a bottle of lye under the counter to throw in the face of robbers who came in. And people described houses on St. John's Place as looking like a bomb had gone off. You know, this was before the plane came down. There was a lot of white flight to the suburbs. Banks would not give mortgages to people who wanted to live there. And also real estate agents who wanted to buy buildings and chop them up into rooming houses would try and sort of scare the residents with sort of racially coded discussions. You know, oh, this neighborhood's really getting worse. You better sell now. But nobody really explored that day what this neighborhood was going through. So we sort of re-reported that world, and you'd learn more from Emily's story than about Park Slope than you would of any of the stories at the time.
Do you think today we would have similar kinds of teachable moments about neighborhoods that hosted disasters?
Absolutely. Several years ago, there was a terrible fire in the Bronx, and 10 children were killed. I helped run that coverage on the Metro section of the Times, and we really looked at this community. We looked at the type of housing stock that's there and how some of it is not inspected properly and let this fire happen. So we used this disaster as a way to show the city this whole world. And it was great journalism to be part of. And you didn't really see that in the Park Slope coverage at the time. Another fascinating thing is we have some radio from then that talks about the plane crash live. And none of the reporters say what neighborhood it is. They just say, we're in Brooklyn.
We're talking to you from the scene of the plane crash in Brooklyn. At the corner of 7th Avenue and Sterling Place, or at least 200 feet from that corner.
They don't know what neighborhood it is. They've never been there. They got there. They looked at the street sign. And even in the newspapers, it does mention Park Slope, but only fleeting.
So we've talked about changes in the way we report the who of disasters and also the where. Let's talk about now the most stark difference between then and now, which is the why.
Absolutely. It's fascinating to read the descriptions of why these two planes came down. The United plane was a DC-8 jet headed to Idlewild. The Lockheed Constellation was a TWA plane. It was going to LaGuardia.
Both airports were in Queens. The airport then called Idlewild is now called Kennedy Airport.
That's correct. You know, the newspapers at the time that I've seen didn't really try and find out themselves why this had happened. They accepted this report from the government. The jet overshot its holding pattern. One of its transponders was out, so it didn't know where it was. Oh, well, you almost have this sense of reading it. You know, this stuff happens with those crazy things flying around up in the sky. Nobody stopped and said, wait a minute, how could a plane so easily overshoot its holding pattern? And Patrick McGeehan, who was a reporter at the Times, who did the story about this aspect of it for our series, learned that at the time, there were no speed limits on jet planes. Jet passenger planes were new. He was going 600 miles an hour over New York City. So when he overshot his holding pattern, before he even knew it, he had overshot it by 12 miles. I think today, rather than wait for the government to tell us what had happened and just accept that as the final word and move on, you know, we dig very hard to figure out, well, are these rules even appropriate? Do we need to do more? And indeed, in time, this crash did lead to all sorts of rules about speed flying over urban areas.
You're publishing some of these stories in the actual paper and all of them on the City Room blog. Why devote so many resources to something that happened 50 years ago? Did you have a conversation with your bosses about this?
I told Joe Sexton, the Metro editor, what I wanted to do. He said, great, sounds terrific. I will admit that some of the reporters have become so passionate about this project that it got bigger than I had initially planned. Emily Rube, our producer, has created all of this multimedia stuff, including audio from that time and interviews with people who remember it. And, you know, just today, Andy Newman did a great story walking around Park Slope, looking at signs of the crash that still linger. And it's a wonderful story because it begins describing, you know, there's a cornice missing from one apartment building because the plane's wing hit that building. And there's a modern building on one corner because the brownstone that was there 50 years ago burned to the ground. And these are the sort of things you would expect. But Andy walks you down Sterling Place and eventually takes you into the backyard of a house where a guy has a huge piece of the jet still sitting there that no one ever collected. It's really amazing.
How long before the New York Times of 1960 moved on from this story?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Literally the next day, I believe, there was a fire in a aircraft carrier at the Brooklyn Navy Yard in which 49 people were killed. Another huge story. And our plane crash disappears from coverage, not only in the Times, but in the Daily News and the Herald Tribune and the World Telegram and other papers I've looked at. It's gone. A week later, the report comes out. This is what we think happened. They did that story. Maybe 6 months later, the bigger report from the Civilian Aeronautical Board came out. They reported that story. But boy, did it fade fast. If that were to happen today, God forbid, I could guarantee you weeks of coverage in the Times and the other local newspapers.
Any other decades-old news planned for the paper?
No, I'm taking a break from 1960 New York when we're done with this, and I'm coming back to the present.
I hear some really cool things happened in 1896.
Yes, well, maybe we'll do 1896 Day on the City Room blog, and we'll write as they used to then and have only engravings and Gothic type on all the stories.
Wendell, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wendell Jameson is deputy metro editor for nytimes.com. He oversees the City Room blog, where all of the news reporting about the 1960 plane crash in Park Slope can be found.
The police and fire department are having a difficult time in keeping crowds away from the scene, and even the press, because of the extent of the damage, is held at some distance from the scene, so we cannot give you an accurate report.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Sarah Abdurrahman, with help from Nerida Brownlee, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, and our engineers this week were Dylan Keefe and Rob Granis.
Andy Lancet is WNYC's archivist. Kat Tier Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs and the wind beneath our wings. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Struggling with what to give to the show that has everything? As if. We really need your support. I mean, we really need it. So please consider making an end-of-the-year tax-deductible donation by texting OTM to 25383. A $10 donation will appear on your phone bill, messaging and data rates apply, and maybe this year, Bob will get his wings.